Welcome back. For those of you joining us just now, I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We're podcasting the show. You can find out more information on our website. Go to kalw.org, click on news, and you'll see Your Call listed there. That's where you can listen to our past shows and sign up for our newsletter to find out what we have coming up next. And we always want to get show ideas from our listeners. We'd love to hear your thoughts about what we should cover. You can drop us a line, email us at yourcall@kalw.org, or call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And now we're going to discuss the deal, Trump, Bukele, and the gangs of El Salvador, a revealing frontline investigation produced in collaboration with the premier investigative news outlet El Faro. It examines why President Nayib Bukele of El Salvador took in more than 200 mostly Venezuelan deportees from the United States to be transferred to El Salvador's notorious CICOT prison. These individuals had been detained by the Trump administration on allegations of their gang affiliation. So what was behind this arrangement? And what did both Trump and Bukele stand to gain from it? To discuss the close relationship between the Trump administration and the El Salvador government, we are joined by Carlos Dada, who is an award-winning journalist and the co-founder and director of the independent Salvadoran news outlet El Faro, which has been known to produce very high-quality investigations of corruption and violence. Carlos, welcome to Your Calls Media Roundtable. Well, wonderful to have you on the show. I also want to let listeners know that you can see the documentary. It's called The Deal, Trump, Bukele, and the Gangs of El Salvador. It's available to stream on YouTube, on the PBS app, as well as Frontline's website. And we have a link to it on our website. So go to kalw.org, click on news and Your Call, and you could scroll down to watch it. Highly recommended. It's less than an hour. It's a very compelling documentary. So Carlos, just first want to confirm you can hear me. So hopefully we'll figure out those details. And I can just let listeners know about this documentary. It is really quite a investigative work, a tour de force. And many listeners may recall in the early days of the Trump administration's deporting of individuals from this country that were alleged to have gang affiliations. They were sent down to the CICOT facility in El Salvador. All right. I think Carlos is still trying to join, and we'll see if we can get him on the line. But as this transfer of detainees was happening to El Salvador, just to give folks background here until we can get Carlos on the line here, many people were wondering, well, what is in it for El Salvador? Why would El Salvador want to accept these detainees? As I mentioned, these 200 Venezuelan detainees. And this documentary, The Deal, answers that in a very surprising way. And I'm hoping we can have Carlos here available to join. Do we have Carlos? All right, I think we're struggling to get Carlos on the line. Well, I'm going to go ahead and open up the phone lines, and we'd love to take listener calls at this point while we wait for Carlos to come online. And we know he's trying to connect here. And the number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And we'd love to hear from you. We're going to open the phone lines. Love to take any questions you have about the Trump immigration policies, thoughts you have about that, the role of countries like El Salvador in taking in these deportees, and what that dynamic is like. So definitely want to hear from listeners now and open the phone lines while we wait for Carlos to get situated. We know he's calling from outside. I believe he's calling from outside the United States, and these technical difficulties do happen. So again, the number 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Go ahead and give us a ring if you have thoughts about this issue or other ideas for shows that we could potentially cover. Really just want to open the phone lines here on our Your Call Media Roundtable while we have this space on the air. So again, you're listening to Your Call's Media Roundtable. This is Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Number again, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Well, I could, since we're not going to be able to have a ton of time with Carlos once we can get him on, it is truly a remarkable story about Bukele and the deals he cut. And the documentary talks about Bukele's rise. So he started off as a fairly progressive mayor of one of the major cities in El Salvador. And he, at the time, El Salvador was gripped by an unbelievable wave of violence, gang violence. It was called the murder capital of the world. Incredible homicide rates, that the population truly terrorized by all of the gang violence that was happening.
Thank you, Ken.
And I think we have Carlos here. Carlos, can you hear me?
Hi, Kevin. Sorry, I had some technical problems, but I think I managed to resolve them. Thanks for having me here.
All right, great. Yeah, so it sounds like our engineer, Kevin Vance, has been able to get you, our board operator has been able to get you online. Great to have you with us, Carlos. I was just speaking a bit about the sort of the beginnings of your documentary as you trace the rise of Bukele and how he was a fairly progressive politician at first, responding to the wave of violence in El Salvador. Can you talk about how Bukele's rise sort of tracked this public sentiment, this public really sort of despair over the amount of violence that was happening in El Salvador?
Thank you, Ethan. I know it sounds almost unbelievable now, but Bukele started in the extreme leftist party FMLN, the former guerrillas. He started his political career as a mayor of a very small town in the suburbs of San Salvador. And he displayed a lot of modernity in his first political exercise, trying to bring technology to this little town, spending money that basically the small town could not afford for this, for a lot of things. But this brought the attention at national level. From there, he jumped to the capital city, to San Salvador. He became mayor of San Salvador. And the first thing he did was to clean downtown, which means taking the gangs out of downtown San Salvador and making it again a place that everybody could visit without the fear of being extorted or killed by the gangs. What we didn't know by then is that this was due to a pact he had already established with the gangs. And the rest is history. I'm saying this sounds even unbelievable now, because right now Mr. Bukele's political exercise is almost libertarian. I mean, he's to the right of the extreme right now. But he started in the left and he sounded very progressive in every single issue. He looked as the modern face of the left in Central America.
Well, it's amazing what happened. So as you say, he started off as fairly, progressive left, comes into office on the sort of wave of anti-crime sentiment and has really remarkable success, almost overnight success, seeming to cut back on these murders. And so pick up the story from there. So what happened as you're looking at this, all of a sudden this, these murders kind of seem to disappear. How did this happen and what did you find out?
Mr. Bukele claimed to have a secret security plan that needed to be secret so the bad guys would not know what he was doing. And it proved very effective from day number one of his presidency. The homicide rate lowered so much that we knew that this was not normal, that this could not be due to a security plan, because things don't change from night to day. And we had a lot of experience covering gang activities, and by then already gangs had become political actors who had negotiated with every single political force in El Salvador. So it was not surprising to find out that the dramatic descent in homicide rates in El Salvador was due to a deal that Mr. Bukele had secretly made with the gangs.
We're speaking with Carlos Dada, award-winning journalist and co-founder and director of the independent Salvador news outlet El Faro. We're talking about his new documentary, frontline documentary, The Deal, Trump, Bukele, and the Gangs of El Salvador. So Carlos, Mr. Bukele made this deal with these gangs. Were the murders actually stopped at that point, or did they just sort of have an agreement with the gangs in terms of how they could conduct their killings?
I think there's not a simple answer to this, Ethan. I think that, but we don't know because we don't have enough information. I'm going to tell you what we know so far. Homicides actually did descend, but homicides were still being committed by the gangs for a simple reason. The gangs' economic life depends on extorting people. And extortion is only effective if there's a punishment for not paying. And that punishment usually was death. So if you don't pay the gangs, you are killed. So when this deal was cut with Mr. Bukele, which meant the gangs could not keep on their killing spree, then the gangs were basically out of business. They had no income anymore. What we learned recently is that part of the deal is that the liaison from Bukele's government with the gangs literally told them, whatever you do, we don't want to see bodies. No body, no crime. And this coincides with a lot of disappearances in El Salvador. The homicide rate descended, but the disappearing numbers did not descend. So that can give you some clues of what really happened.
And maybe we should back up a little bit here. Can you just talk about the genesis of these gangs in El Salvador? How did they become such a powerful force in the country?
I think it was thanks to a U.S. president called Bill Clinton. And before him, George Bush's father. This is what happened, Ethan. The gangs were born in California streets. A lot of these Salvadoran gang members were children displaced by our civil war during the 80s that ended up in California in very dysfunctional families by then, with one of the parents killed and without a lot of financial healthy life, let's put it that way, family separated. So these kids grew up on the streets. When the war was over in 1992, then the United States decided to start deporting Salvadoran gang members. They were still Salvadoran citizens, but they could barely speak Spanish. Some of them didn't even speak a word of Spanish. So they went back to a country that was just coming out of a civil war with a strong culture of violence, which is what wars leave, with a lot of weapons that no one knew where they were, with a social tissue completely broken. And besides of that, with a whole country focused on maintaining a peace agreement and starting to live a democratic life. So these kids come from California and they convince other disenfranchised kids in El Salvador to reproduce the gang structures that they learned in California. So that's how gangs are transported from California to El Salvador.
Unbelievable history and connection to California, not the kind of export we'd like to see coming out of the state. Very unfortunate history. Well, let's fast forward from that era of Bill Clinton to Donald Trump. When did the Trump administration realize that it could forge a close alliance with Bukele in order to send these hundreds of people to the notorious Cicot prison there?
During the Biden administration, remember that Biden established some basic rules for his political policies, particularly to Latin America. He was demanding more democracy, more transparency, and a stronger fight against corruption. Mr. Bukele did not fulfill those requests from the Biden administration, so they basically clashed. And Bukele bet his own political future. He bet everything to the return of the Trump administration. So by then, he started to establish very strong conducts of communication with the MAGA movement, with the movement of supporters and operators of political operators of Mr. Trump, people like Matt Gaetz, people like by then Senator Rubio, people like Tucker Carlson, people like the Trump family. So he started to make these strong connections and he started to position himself as the main reference of the of this current of the right movement in Latin America, and as the direct connection between the MAGA movement and Latin America. So he bet everything to Mr. Trump going back to the White House, and he won that bet. So basically, when Mr. Trump comes back, Rubio is made Secretary of State. His first trip outside the United States is to Central America. He visits Panama, Dominican Republic, and he stops by in El Salvador. And he cuts this deal with Mr. Bukele. We can't call it an agreement because we have not seen it, Evan. I mean, bear in mind that even Congress men and women, U.S. Congress representatives have asked for this agreement, and the Trump administration keeps answering that this is an agreement that cannot be disclosed because it endangers national security and foreign policy and blah, blah, blah. So this is how the relationship becomes so strong. And Mr. Bukele, of course, offers Mr. Trump something that was part of Mr. Trump's promise to his voters, to get rid of those, quote, unwanted people, end of quote, which meant undocumented immigrants, which meant foreign criminals. And Bukele said, send them all to me. But then he puts a condition, right?
Yeah, so let's talk about that condition. What was in it for Bukele to accept these detainees?
2 days after Mr. Rubio leaves El Salvador, the Salvadoran ambassador to Washington, Milena Mayorga, goes on Salvadoran TV, and she discloses something that really surprised us. She said she was in the meeting between Secretary Rubio and President Bukele, and that Bukele, and she said, asked as a matter of honor that the gang leaders that were in New York be sent back to El Salvador in the same flights with those deportees or those people that Mr. Trump wanted to send to El Salvador. So what's the deal with these gang members? Some of them, first of all, they know exactly all the details of the deal between Mr. Bukele and the gangs. And some of them were illegally freed by Mr. Bukele and secretly freed, asked for extradition by the United States, but they are freed by Mr. Bukele. And some of them, particularly one, Elmer Canales Crook, is recaptured in Mexico and sent to the United States. So there's nine leaders of MS-13 gang awaiting for trial in New York. Mr. Bukele finds it as a priority in his relationship with the rest of the world that these gang leaders do not have their day in court because they can reveal the details of their pact. Meaning, this will make Mr. Bukele officially in front of the U.S. judicial system a partner of a terrorist organization. So it's a matter of urgency for Mr. Bukele to bring these gang leaders back to El Salvador before they can reveal all these details in court. And the first one was already sent with the Venezuelan. So there's eight remaining in New York.
Just having some technical difficulties here, and I'm going to be joining here from Zoom. So thank you for that, and apologies. One question I had for you as you tell this story is how did your El Faro, how did your reporters get access to this information? It's truly unbelievable reporting that you were able to accomplish.
Thank you very much for your kind words, Ethan. We have been investigating organized crime in Central America for decades now. So we have sources in a lot of places, which is how you do journalism of this kind. So we received a package of documents from inside the prison system that revealed all the entrances and people getting out of the prison. And all these registers told us of Mr. Bukele's government officers and gang members entering and leaving the prison to make these kind of deals. And then this information was corroborated or confirmed by sources inside the gang, inside the police, inside the Attorney General's office. So we could have what we call a journalistic truth, which means we applied an editorial process that allowed us to confirm that indeed there was a deal between Mr. Bukele and the gangs.
And El Faro reporters have faced a lot of personal sacrifices from uncovering these stories. Can you talk about what has happened to the reporters on the ground? And I know that you personally have had to leave Venezuela because of threats that you and your colleagues faced. What has been the sort of personal toll of covering this story?
If you allow me the small correction, not Venezuela, but El Salvador. Indeed.
El Salvador. Apologies for that. I know that there was reporting in Venezuela that that was controversial as well.
Yes, yes, of course. Yes, we started receiving threats and huge campaigns of delegitimation by the Bukele government, basically since its start. Then I'm going to tell you this because I think it adds to the explanation of what you asked or to the reply. We discovered by the end of 2021 that 22 out of 30 members of El Faro, we had our phones hacked with the Israeli spyware Pegasus. And so Citizen Lab, which is this organization in the University of Toronto specialized on Pegasus, gave us the logs. We were hacked for a year and a half, which was obsessive according to Citizen Lab. But what we did is that we crossed the logbooks of every single intromission into every single phone. We crossed that information with our publishing cycles. To no surprise, the most intense moments of hacking to the biggest amount of El Faro members was around our publications about Bukele's deals with the gangs and the scandals of corruption in his government during the COVID pandemics. So that's when it started. So, and then he had already concentrated a lot of power. He's building a dictatorship in El Salvador. So he basically launched a lot of the state institutions against us, including, for example, what would be the equivalent of the IRS in the United States that was auditing us for tax evasion. He accused me personally, Mr. Bukele accused me personally on a national address of laundering money. Then we were accused of every single thing you can find in the book of crimes of El Salvador, of being partners of terrorist organizations, of being defenders of corrupt people, of being corrupt ourselves, blah, 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 blah. So we were facing a lot of surveillance, drones entering the windows of some of our houses, for example, in my apartment. So we were facing legal threats and legal cases, legal challenges. We were facing, again, surveillance of the classic kind of and of the modern kind. We were facing delegitimation campaigns. We were facing the use of government media platforms to make up stories about us, you name it. We basically filed a complaint in California, by the way, in a California federal court against a civil case against NSO. NSO is an Israeli company that produces Pegasus. So we have tried to keep on doing journalism, but as you may imagine, Ethan, this has consumed so many resources from us in defending ourselves. We had to move El Faro to Costa Rica to get off the possibility of grabbing from Mr. Bukele, and it's a very long story.
It's really an amazing story, and I'm just so appreciative that you've been. I'm sorry you've had to deal with all of these attacks and setbacks, but it's just remarkable that you've been able to bring these stories to light. So are there any El Faro journalists left in El Salvador at this point?
In last May, when we published interviews with two gang members on video that were supposed also to be in prison and they were free talking to us, then Mr. Bukele and his regime decided it was enough. Bear in mind that we are entering our fifth year of living under state of emergency in El Salvador, which means a police can arrest anyone without the need of a judge order and just put him into prison for an indeterminate amount of time. And so this regime, the state of emergency that is supposed to be fighting gangs, has been used to go after critics of the government. So after we published this interview, the government decided to go full-fledged against its critics. Yeah. He incarcerated human rights defenders, and he the Attorney General's office, who serves Mr. Bukele, issued also detention orders against reporters. So all of our newsroom is in exile now. But I'm telling you this, Ethan, because we're not an exception. Most of the human rights organizations, human rights defenders have left the country. Most of independent journalists have left the country. According to the Salvadoran Association of Journalists, there's around 60 journalists that have already left the country.
Yes. Well, we're just about out of time. I just have to close by asking you, how are you able to do your work now going forward in exile, just very briefly?
Of course, I can't give you the details of that, but as you can imagine, it's the usual methods. You keep your sources, you try to keep a foot on the ground, even if you're not there. But to be honest, Ethan, we are facing now this big challenge. I don't have all the answers of how we are going to do this. We just hope to be able to do this.
Well, Carlos Dada, award-winning journalist, co-founder and director of El Faro, thank you so much for joining us on Your Calls Media Roundtable, and just wishing you the best of luck. And thank you for your work bringing these stories to light.
Thank you very much for your interest, Ethan. Thank you to Malihe. It's been a pleasure to be here.
It was wonderful to have you. The documentary, again, is called The Deal, Trump, Bukele, and the Gangs of El Salvador, available to stream on YouTube, PBS app, and Frontline's website. You can find it on our website. That's it for our show today. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. For information on this program or any other program that we have, or any other show we have in our lineup, visit us on our website at kalw.org. Click on news and you'll see Your Call there. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind. It's Your Call.